Good morning, everyone. This morning's class is entitled Loving and Obeying God. It's the first century AD, and sometime in the early afternoon, Akiva the Jew approaches the great temple of Herod. It's Passover week, and he needs to make a sacrifice. Traditionally, of course, the only sacrifice he needs to make is the Passover lamb. But Passover week is one of those times when people feel particularly pious, so it tends to be the time when they bring a whole lot of other sacrifices as well to make up for the ones they've neglected during the year. Akiva lives inside Jerusalem, and his property is too small for livestock. So he brings money to buy an animal at the temple. The law of Moses did actually make allowance for this. It stated that you could bring money to buy a sacrifice if you needed to, although strictly speaking, this only applied to the annual tithe. Over time, the Sanhedrin had read and reread the relevant passages and concluded it pretty much extended to every sacrifice he cared to name. It was more convenient that way. Akiva trusts the Sanhedrin to interpret the law correctly, so he feels perfectly fine with this. The last time he offered a sacrifice was last Passover. Akiva rubs his ear and scratches his beard in that nervous way men do when their conscience has just given them a sharp nudge. Married men, you may replace conscience with wife. But Akiva considers himself a deeply religious man. He attends synagogue every Sabbath, and he has a Greek copy of the Jewish scriptures at home. He dips into it about three times a week. Admittedly, he only tends to read his favourite passages, but the thought is there. He does his best to lead a moral life, and he tries to follow the complicated instructions of the Pharisees and Sadducees, who have now added so many new rules to the law of Moses that interpreting them is a full-time job for the scribes. But at some point, Akiva had begun to neglect the sacrifices. At first, it was just the little ones, which cropped up so many times that they became inconvenient. Then it was the more important ones, because he felt they merely duplicated some of the rituals he already performed at synagogue. And now the annual Passover lamb is the only sacrifice he offers regularly. Akiva justifies this to himself on the basis that it's more important to feel comfortable with the way you worship God than it is to follow a set of traditions which seem increasingly irrelevant to modern urban life. Surely God will understand and make allowances. The population of Jerusalem at this time was around 50,000, but at Passover week it tripled to 150,000. This made city life almost unbearable, and Akiva finds himself wondering if it might also offer an excuse to stop keeping the Passover himself. The laborious process of visiting the temple, fighting your way through the crowds, choosing a sacrifice, waiting in line to offer it, could take half a day at least. That's not Akiva's idea of religion. He wants a private spiritual experience involving family, maybe a few chosen friends, good food, and adequate parking. Religion shouldn't have to involve mixing people you wouldn't normally see every day. Picking his way through the crowded streets, Akiva suddenly catches sight of the temple complex. unless he stops to admire it, he reflects on its controversial history. This temple had been built by Herod the Great. Ironically, it wasn't even necessary. The temple of Zerubbabel was still standing. Herod had chosen to replace it. Herod himself was originally governor of Galilee, and he collaborated with Rome for political advantage. In 40 BC, the Senate rewarded him with a unique title. They called him King of the Jews. After surviving a brief civil war, he became Tetrarch of Judea in 36 BC. But the Jews didn't accept Herod as their king. They resented him because his father was an Edomite, making Herod only half Jewish. And Herod's life was not a typical Jewish life. He built pagan temples to appease the Romans. He had no respect for the Mosaic law. Nevertheless, Herod was a shrewd politician. When the Jewish leaders grew restless, he offered to replace the Temple of Zerubbabel, which had been unfavorably compared with Solomon's from the very first day it was built. Following some complex and highly suspicious negotiations with the Sanhedrin, Herod provided all the materials for the new temple before demolishing the old one. He built it from the foundations up. The temple resided on a small mountain. It finished in a plateau, which seemed ideal for a new construction. But Herod wasn't satisfied. He effectively halved the size of the mountain. He cut it down even further and created a broader space to spread his grand design. Herod knew that the Jews were deeply sensitive to the religious significance of the temple, and he hired 1,000 priests to carry out the main work on the temple building itself. Then, for more than half a century, 10,000 additional skilled workmen labored under his direction. Although Herod's temple was roughly the same size as Solomon's, the site was much larger, and the courts which surrounded it, not part of the original design, were immense. The temple itself was complete after 1.5 years, but the vast external buildings took decades to finish. In John chapter 2, verse 20, the Jewish leaders confirm that construction is still ongoing after 46 years. Akiva finally looks away from the temple and continues walking, but his eyes are constantly drawn back to it. It was coated in marble and gold. It could be seen from miles away. It dominated the city. Akiva murmurs a popular saying, which is now recorded in the Talmud: "He who has not seen Herod's temple has never seen anything beautiful." And yet, it was built by an Edomite. Akiva shakes his head at this painful irony. He has heard from the rabbis that the presence of Yahweh departed from Israel when Solomon's temple was destroyed by the Babylonians. And there was no Shekinah glory in the two temples which followed. Many people have interpreted this as a sign from God, and Akiva is inclined to agree. But what would it take for the glory of Yahweh to return to his temple? Akiva doesn't even know where to begin with that question. As he begins the long walk down the marble flagstones of the Gentiles' court, Akiva looks up and runs his eyes down the porches which surround it on all four sides. These covered walkways are at least 244 meters long and at least 33 meters high at the roof. Solomon's temple had nothing like these. They were designed and built exclusively by Herod. And today, Akiva is distracted by the Corinthian columns which support the roof. The Corinthian style was a distinct feature of Greek architecture, was commonly found in pagan temples. Its presence here is a strange contradiction to a Jewish place of worship. Crossing the Gentiles' court, Akiva takes a detour into what's known as Solomon's porch. Tradition stated that this was the hall of judgment in which King Solomon had dispensed wisdom and justice. Many people found it a good place to meditate, at least not when it was Passover week. The Jewish historian Josephus believed it was actually a part of Solomon's original temple which still remained after the captivity. He believed it was preserved by the foreign invaders out of respect for its beauty. Josephus wrote, "Its fineness to those who had not seen it was incredible, and to those who had seen it, greatly amazing." Solomon's porch is absolutely packed, and Akiva can't actually relax here. So he squeezes his way back into the court of the Gentiles. As he does so, he winces at the sound of bleating lambs, frustrated goats, and caged pigeons. This was the area where the animals were bought and sold and money changed. It wasn't considered a part of this sacred temple space, so people felt free to do with it what they wished. The sheer volume of animals, the tremendous numbers of people during Passover week, the noise of the trading and the greed of those who traded seemed to permeate the entire temple site. It made a mockery of any distinction between sacred and mundane space. Even worse, Josephus tells us that it was rumored that Annas, the high priest, not only approved of commercial activity in the court of the Gentiles, but actually received a significant percentage of the profits. Akiva covers his nose with his sleeve and moves quickly to the money changers' table. Even local currency needs to be changed here because the Jewish religious leaders had introduced a law stating that no money with an imprint could be used in the temple courts. Publicly, they said this was necessary to avoid breaking the second of the Ten Commandments, the prohibition against graven images. Privately, they agreed it was a fantastic way to squeeze more money out of Passover week. The money changer is a greasy, long-fingered man who sweeps Akiva's large pile of money into a bag and replaces it with a few blank silver coins. The exchange rate is shocking, even worse than last year. Akiva's disappointment shows on his face. The money changer gives an apologetic shrug, and Akiva, struggling with a fist that is now clenched discreetly behind his back, turns away. His next challenge arrives at the animal trader's stall. Here he surveys a bunch of tired-looking lambs with an unpleasant skin condition. A similar stall, just several meters away, offers far superior animals, but with prices to match. Akiva's blank coins won't go far. He has to take whatever he can get. The entire sacrificial system has been reduced to, well, what amounts to little more than good luck rather than good management. Sometimes you are met at the altar by a casual priest in hastily prepared robes whose swift glance at your offering could not even be called a long stare, let alone a thorough examination. But at other times, the priest in charge is meticulous, refusing even the finest looking animal. He will send you back for a new one again and again, until at last, after you've given half your money to the trader with whom he has a special arrangement, he will graciously accept your offering. Generally speaking, most of the priests don't really seem to care very much these days, and it's common knowledge that the purchase of a genuinely spotless animal is only done for the sake of the outward show. That's a privilege reserved for the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and very few others. Akiva haggles aggressively with the trader after realizing that these animals are not local, but imported. This means there's no guarantee that they've been raised by Jews and carefully penned up in accordance with the strict rules of the Passover preparation. The two men finally agree on a price which Akiva still considers ridiculous. He grits his teeth and leads away a small, grubby lamb of dubious parentage with a suspicious-looking leg. The court of the Gentiles is unbearably hot, and Akiva has already been here for more than 2 hours. He turns towards the temple and drags his lamb through the packed mass of Jews and Gentiles. There is some relief from the crowd when he reaches the short perimeter wall which surrounds the main temple complex. This wall is only waist high. It's symbolic. Its purpose is to separate Jewish space from Gentile space. Gaps in the wall allow passage through to the main temple, and at these points the wall bears a sign stating that Gentiles are forbidden from coming any closer on pain of death. Akiva waits for a moment to make sure some Gentiles are looking, and slowly walks past the wall with a smug grin on his face. He does this every year. It never gets old. One more doorway brings him into the court of the women. This is a much smaller space, and people are even more tightly packed here than outside. It takes Akiva another hour to cross the court of the women. By this time, he's accidentally overheard a dozen different conversations involving 3 divorces, 8 marriages, 2 deaths, and 6 births. Finally, he reaches the steps of the Nicanor Gate. He slowly climbs them to the top, dragging his feet now, tired, fed up, distracted. Through the Nicanor Gate, he can see the altar and the court of the priests. Next to the court of the priests, he can see the much smaller court of Israel, where the men wait to sacrifice. The Nicanor Gate shines in the afternoon sun. It consists of 2 massive doors plated with Corinthian brass, a highly expensive alloy perfected in the classical period by Gentile metalworkers. Akiva squints at the doors and realizes that he can see his own reflection in them. This is the ultimate insult, a gate into the temple courtyard which reflects the image of a human being. Every Jew who approaches it at a certain angle will, in some sense, breach the second commandment without even noticing. He can't help suspecting that this was carefully planned by Herod himself. Because despite building the temple in accordance with guidelines laid down by Scripture, Herod had deliberately surrounded it with a network of new buildings inspired by pagan architecture. The temple was not easily accessible. It was locked in, surrounded by a stifling Gentile influence. The Jews had to move in and out of that Gentile influence every time they went to worship. And after a while, it began to permeate their minds. At one point, Herod had even placed a Roman eagle on the outer gate of the temple court so that the Jews had to walk beneath it every time they entered the court of the Gentiles. He removed it eventually after threats of riot. But it told the Jews what he really thought of them. Akiva knows of some Jews who have had enough of this whole system. They are called the Essenes, a small group of conservative radicals who taught that the temple sacrifices were irretrievably corrupted and no longer acceptable to God. They refused to use the temple. They couldn't accept it. They hated what it had become. They'd moved out to their own community in the Qumran Valley. Over time, their views changed and modified somewhat, but they couldn't bring themselves to return. They couldn't rejoin the rest of the Jewish community. And ironically, it's the Essenes who preserved so many of the scriptures that are available to us today. The Dead Sea Scrolls are their legacy. In their own way, they performed a vital, entirely spiritual, entirely noble service. But their mistake was withdrawing from the community instead of working within it to try and help repair the damage. Akiva closes his eyes and tries to block out the distractions around him. The chattering, the laughing, the gossiping, the debating, the men all talking about themselves, the women all talking about other people. Nobody is talking about God. He closes his eyes and he recites a few verses from Malachi chapter 3. Let's go there now. Malachi chapter 3, commencing in verse 1. I am about to send my messenger who will clear the way before me. Indeed, the Lord you are seeking will suddenly come to his temple. And the messenger of the covenant whom you long for is certainly coming, says Yahweh, who rules over all. Who can endure the day of his coming? Who can keep standing when he appears? For he will be like a refiner's fire, like a launderer's soap. He will act like a refiner and purifier of silver, and will cleanse the Levites and refine them like gold and silver. Then they will offer the Lord a proper offering. The offerings of Judah and Jerusalem will be pleasing to Yahweh, as in former times and years past. This is Akiva's favorite passage. It's a personal meditation. But today, it has no effect. He looks over at the altar. He looks down at his lamb. He can't do this anymore. He doesn't know what's brought him to the temple today, but it's not faith. It's not hope. It's not even guilt. He doesn't care enough for guilt. He recognizes some of the people around him. They're members of his own synagogue. He knows their names, but he's never actually spent any time with them outside the Sabbath worship. And why would he? They'd have nothing in common, at least nothing he can start a conversation with. He's not even sure if he likes them. He doesn't actually know them well enough to know if he likes them. They're just faces in the Sabbath crowd. Akiva gives up. He slowly walks down the steps from the Nicanor gate. He's going home. He can't worship at the temple. Doesn't mean anything to him. He's been going through the motions for years, and now he's finally admitted that it was just habit that brought him here, not genuine obedience. He's not motivated by a relationship with God. He's running on a sort of spiritual autopilot that makes him offer the same tired prayer every year as he repeats the same grueling rituals with mechanical precision. He reaches one of the gates leading to the court of the women. His foot steps onto the flagstone of the court of the Gentiles. And then the shouting starts. Come with me to Mark chapter 11. Mark chapter 11, commencing in verse 15. Then they came to Jerusalem. Jesus entered the temple area and began to drive out those who were selling and buying in the temple courts. He turned over the tables of the money changers and the chairs of those selling doves. He would not permit anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. Then he began to teach them. And he said, "Is it not written, 'My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations?' But you have turned it into a den of robbers." The chief priests and the experts in the law heard it, and they considered how they could assassinate him. For they feared him, because the whole crowd was amazed by his teaching. Akiva is first shocked, then terrified, then curiously thrilled. He can't understand how a single man is successfully defying a crowd of thousands. He can't understand why the temple guards are standing nervously at the edge of the crowd, fumbling with their weapons, seemingly incapable of taking action. His body trembles as an incredible aura of power and authority radiates from the angry Galilean. It floods the entire courtyard. It has an instant effect. People have stopped shouting. Some are praying. Some are crying. Very few are still standing. And Akiva spontaneously recalls the words of Malachi chapter 1. Let's go there now. Malachi chapter 1. Commencing in verse 11. "For from the east to the west, my name will be great among the nations. Incense and pure offerings will be offered in my name everywhere. For my name will be great among the nations, says Yahweh, who rules over all. But you are profaning it by saying that the table of the Lord is common and its offerings despicable. You also say, 'How tiresome it is.' You turn up your nose at it, says Yahweh, who rules over all. And instead you bring what is stolen, lame, or sick. You bring these things for an offering? Should I accept this from you?" asks Yahweh. "There will be harsh condemnation for the hypocrite who has a valuable male animal in his flock, but vows and sacrifices something inferior to the Lord. For I am a great king, says Yahweh, who rules over all. And my name is awesome among the nations." If Akiva had been present in the opening verses of Mark 11, he might have understood the significance of what he saw The chapter begins with the entrance of Jesus into Jerusalem, where he is hailed as King of the Jews. A group of Pharisees in the crowd insists that he should rebuke his followers. They understand how dangerous this is. They recognize what's happening here. If Jesus believes himself to be the Messiah, he can be expected to present himself in two separate roles. First, as a king, and then as a priest. Watching enviously, the Pharisees are horrified by the symbolic overtones of this event. Jesus has assumed the first messianic role, King of Israel, Son of David. And there's a panic among them when Jesus turns his face to the temple. And he enters. And he looks all around him. He takes it in, slowly, silently. And the Pharisees breathe a sigh of relief as Jesus walks out of the temple, leaves Jerusalem, and spends the night in Bethany. But the next day, Jesus returns, and his return is dramatic. This is exactly what the Pharisees had dreaded. Jesus assumes the second messianic role, the high priest of his people. There are more nervous meetings among the Pharisees. The Sadducees take counsel together. The chief priests and the scribes think of ways to kill him. But nobody charges him with any breach of the law. And this is very strange. Even at his trial, the temple cleansing is never raised. If any other man but Jesus of Nazareth had tried to do what he did, the chief priests, the scribes, the Sanhedrin would have eliminated him without a second thought. But Jesus was different. His actions were consistent with his words, and his words could not be refuted because his doctrine came from God. If this had been a simple matter of popularity, Jesus' ministry would not have prevailed. There had been many men before him who claimed to be the Messiah. Some of them rose and fought the Romans. Some of them had followers in the tens of thousands. Some of them battled local Roman generals. Some of them ended up crucified on the Appian Way with their followers. But Jesus could prove his claims in a way that no other man could. And Jesus had a power, an authority that nobody had seen before. And it made the Sanhedrin very reluctant to move against him. And this is verified by their inaction when he enters Jerusalem. The Pharisees, in their typically argumentative way, tried to hold a debate with Jesus right on the spot. But the chief priests and the scribes were more subtle. They waited for his next move. And then it came, the cleansing of the temple. First the king, and now the priest. They know what's happening here. But when Jesus returns to Jerusalem for the second time, they are ready for him. Jesus' response in the temple, his first response, silently taking it all in, is very interesting because it meant that nobody could accuse him of a mad knee-jerk reaction when he finally came back and cleansed the temple. Nobody could say this was just some unsophisticated Galilean peasant who was not familiar with the sophisticated way of urban living. Nobody could claim he was just a religious zealot overcome by emotion. He'd already been in the temple many times before. He'd gone in quite deliberately and done nothing but look around. Jesus was very careful to act in a precise way, a meaningful way. When Jesus raised his voice, it actually meant something. And look at the way the Sanhedrin respond to him in Mark 11, verse 27. What they actually say isn't precisely what they mean. While Jesus was walking in the temple courts, the chief priests, the experts in the law, and the elders came up to him and said, "By what authority are you doing these things? Or who gave you the authority to do these things?" Jesus said to them, "I will ask you one question. Answer me, and I will tell you by what authority I do these things. John's baptism, was it from heaven or from people? Answer me." They discussed with one another, saying, "If we say from heaven, he will say, 'Then why didn't you believe him?' But if we say from people," they feared the crowd, for all considered John to be truly a prophet. So they answered Jesus, "We don't know." And Jesus said to them, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I'm doing these things." The spoken question is, "By what authority do you do these things? Who gave you the authority to do these things?" The question behind it, the real question, is, "On what basis are you claiming to be the Messiah?" And Jesus traps them with one of his unanswerable questions. The Sanhedrin can either deny the authority of John at the risk of losing the people's support, or accept the authority of John at the risk of losing their credibility. Ironically, of course, if they lose their credibility, they also lose the people. It's lose-lose for the Sanhedrin. So they sidestep, "We don't know." Jesus is under no obligation now to answer their question. In fact, their inability to answer his question only serves to reinforce his own authority. And I think his enemies realized that of all the miracles Jesus had performed elsewhere, the cleansing of the temple was beyond compare. And we who find it so difficult to cleanse our own hearts and minds, the temple of the living God, whose servants we are, cannot afford to underestimate the events of Mark 11. Like Akiva, we struggle with the inconsistency of our service, our doubts, our fears, our personal cynicism. Like Akiva, we struggle with the subtle Gentile influences which have slowly encroached upon our personal lives and distract us from our service to God. Like Akiva, we would love to return to the days when our spiritual sacrifices were pure and our response to God was spontaneous, not ritualistic. But like Akiva, we can be inspired by the selfless example of Jesus. Only he could cleanse the temple of Herod, for only he was spiritually pure. He performed the physically impossible. He performed the spiritually impossible. When he drove the animal traders from the Gentiles' court, he was symbolically removing the requirements of the law. He was making it possible for us to enter the temple without a literal sacrifice. The challenge for us is to approach God every week, or whenever we do approach him, without taking this privilege for granted or failing to appreciate its true spiritual depth. To share communion with brothers and sisters, not just because it's what we've always done, not because it's the best place to meet our friends and catch up with gossip, not because it's a pleasant way to spend a Sunday afternoon and morning and evening even, but because we know that we need to be there, and we want to be there, and we are hungry for the peace, the fellowship, the love, the exaltation, and the vital relationship with God that can only be found at the Lord's table. Obedience to God's will is an essential part of the Christian life, but it means nothing without the right motivation. The Pharisees and Sadducees were obedient. In some respects, they were probably the most obedient Jews of their time. They were fanatically dedicated to the law of Moses. They memorized it and repeated it, and they performed every single task, every obscure ritual, every principle, every precept. They could recite it by memory. They wrote entire commentaries on a single verse. They argued for hours over the position of a single clause. And having mastered every aspect of the law, they had the supreme arrogance to upgrade it by adding laws of their own. Hundreds of pointless traditions accumulated over centuries of ritual habit and academic debate. But this unhealthy obsession resulted in a mass of divisions, warring factions, and irreconcilable splits. Instead of uniting the Jews, it tore them apart. It left them vulnerable to Gentile influence. It weakened their community in tragic ways. At the time of Jesus' ministry, people had become frustrated, disillusioned, confused, fatigued. Some left their community for other faiths. Others remained within it, but only because they lacked the energy to do anything else. Almost invariably, they succumbed to the ritualistic obedience taught by the Pharisees and Sadducees, going through the motions of religion without any spiritual commitment to it. And perhaps some would argue that they had little choice. They might claim it wasn't really their fault, that their environment precluded any chance of spiritual growth, that the exhortations they received from their rabbis were consistently poor, that there was not enough motivation within their synagogue, that there was not enough love or joy or sobriety or whatever else they thought was lacking. But that's no excuse. Whatever conditions we might find in our ecclesia, in our wider community, there are few which cannot be changed or improved. We can remain and attempt to deal with them, or as a last resort, if all else fails, we can seek another ecclesia in which perhaps more work is capable of being done, more work is needed. The worst options are, of course, to leave altogether, or to create what a brother once referred to as boutique ecclesias. The ecclesias which are perfectly tailor-made for me, with all the other people like me. They're not necessarily related to me, but they share the same ideals. They know what they want in an ecclesia. The boutique ecclesia ticks all the boxes. You don't need to exclude people from a boutique ecclesia because it makes them uncomfortable the moment they walk through the door. So they exclude themselves. That's not your fault. Why is it so important to take responsibility for our own spiritual growth? Because an ecclesia is a single body composed of many members. Because an ecclesia represents a small part of the wider body of Christ. Because our work in the ecclesia, in our community, must seek to benefit not just ourselves, but our brothers and sisters as well. We can come up with plenty of reasons for inaction. It was just too hard. Or, well, if you'd seen my ecclesia, you'd understand. Or, if other people had put in more effort, I wouldn't have lost my own motivation. I think these attitudes are quite common. They're not unique to Christadelphians. But we do need to confront them. And I think this was Akiva's mistake. He blamed his environment for his inability to concentrate on his religious duties. He blamed the system for his inability to maintain a relationship with God. He blamed the repetitive nature of the rituals for his inability to focus on their spiritual significance. Most importantly, he assumed that God would be satisfied with mere obedience. Come with me to John chapter 15. John chapter 15, commencing in verse 5. I am the vine, you are the branches. The one who remains in me and I in him bears much fruit, because apart from me, you can accomplish nothing. If anyone does not remain in me, he is thrown out like a branch and dries up. And such branches are gathered up and thrown into the fire and are burned up. If you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you want, and it will be done for you. My Father is honored by this, that you bear much fruit and show that you are my disciples. Just as the Father has loved me, I have also loved you. Remain in my love. If you obey my commandments, you will remain in my love. Just as I have obeyed my Father's commandments and remain in his love. I have told you these things so that my joy may be in you and your joy may be complete. My commandment is this: to love one another just as I have loved you. Belief in God is worthless unless it makes a difference to our lives and the lives of others. A difference that can be seen, experienced, and recognized by unbelievers. Something that sets us apart from the outside world and prompts others to ask why we are not like them. Faithful Christians are known by their actions as much as their beliefs. A light that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Does our light so shine before men that they may see our good works and glorify our Father who is in heaven? Our answer to that question will determine our need to rediscover God. The Apostle James tells us that faith without works is dead. And that is a basic principle at the very heart of the Christian message. But the opposite of faith without works is a work performed without faith. So we can equally say that works without faith are dead. Obedience means nothing without a righteous motive. What else can we learn from Akiva's experience? We cannot blame our environment for our own lack of commitment. Jesus prepared himself before entering God's house. Our ecclesias aren't temples. They're not God's house in that sense. But do we prepare ourselves before sharing communion with brothers and sisters? Rediscovering God is a cleansing process. Our actions must be consistent with our words, because faith, works without faith are dead. And we are the temple of God.